Jordan-Hare Stadium for tonight's game.
It's the Wishbone Podcast, your source for Auburn football discussion and commentary. Now, here are your hosts, Van Allen Plexico and John Ringer.
Hello, and welcome to the Wishbone Podcast. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined, as always, by my co-host.
I'm John Ringer.
All right, we're sorry we weren't here last week. We had unavoidable family issues, and then the holiday intervened. But now we're back to wrap up Auburn's season and the tremendous changes that are happening even as we record this. And we'll also look back at an Iron Bowl, perhaps after this, better left forgotten as soon as possible. And we will look ahead to what we can expect in the short term and in the long term for Auburn football and Auburn University. Before we get into the Bama game, John, I think we've got some late breaking news. Would you kind of give us an overview of what's happening right now?
Just to give you an idea, it's 2:40 on Sunday afternoon at the time of recording this. Chizik was let go about 30 minutes ago. Auburn has formed a search committee composed of Pat Sullivan, Bo Jackson, Matt Crawford, and Jay Jacobs. Jacobs is apparently keeping his job. I know a lot of people wanted him gone, but he's apparently kept his job, at least for now. So Chizik and all the assistants are gone. The players were informed this afternoon, and the search committee will begin work immediately looking for a replacement coach.
And we'll talk a bit about the whole keeping Jacobs, letting Jacobs go, and everything else in a little bit when we get to the coaching situation. But we've got a lot to talk about today, so I think we should go ahead and dive on into the Alabama game review.
All right.
This may not take too long. But did you make it through the whole thing?
I did. I watched every minute of it. Yeah. And it was entirely predictable.
Yep.
And there was nothing unexpected that happened in that game. I was disappointed that, you know, we talked in our column this week about how we felt like Auburn needed to go for it, more attack, take chances. And I was disappointed that they didn't even bother to do that. There was a point early in the game where they were on the other side of midfield. Auburn had the ball, and it was third and five. And even the Vern and Gary were talking about it. Auburn could have run the ball, picked up 2 to 3 yards, and gone for it a fourth down. It was only, I believe it was only 14 to nothing at that point. And, punting, and I think we ended up punting it in the end zone even on that, or we had one of our terrible shake punts. We didn't gain a lot of field position, and sometimes you have to take chances when you're playing a team that's better than you. But I think at that point, you know, they knew what the deal was, and taking a bunch of chances would only end up with the score being worse, so they didn't bother.
Well, you know, it makes me think about 2009 when people thought we were going to get killed about like this, and we did take every chance in the book, you know, and held on and took them to the last few minutes of the game. So, I mean, there is something to be said for sort of being careful and conservative so that you don't mess up whatever might actually good happen. But on the other hand, you know, we were clearly outclassed, and you got to do something to give yourself a competitive advantage, it seems like.
Well, that makes sense, but the difference in 2009 and now is they had Gus Malzahn coordinating the offense then, and the defense was bad, but it wasn't nearly this bad.
Right.
So we were able to play with them. I mean, we could make it a place, and it was at home. So
while we're talking about the end of the game and everything, the final score and all, I think my favorite moment was when Alabama drove down at the end and could have actually broken the all-time, you know, record for this game. The record was the 1948, 55-0, the first game after we resumed after the 40-year layoff where they didn't play each other. And they drove all the way down to like our, 4 or 5 yard line and then took a knee. And then of course that stops the clock and because of a change of possession. And so Auburn got the ball back with like 9 seconds to go. And that, and what that led to, we'll talk about in a second also, but seeing Saban lose his mind, furious at the referee, because Saban, apparently, not the referee, had forgotten that when there's a change of possession, the clock stops. I mean, he just was taking a knee, I think, so that the game would end. And, you know, he didn't – for whatever reason, Saban didn't seem to realize that we would actually get the ball back, and he was really upset. So – and, of course, on the next play, of course, we you know, Trey Mason gets his 1,000 yards. So the one bright, shining point in the whole game. So I just thought it was hilarious that in a game where it's 49-0 against your big rival and you're taking a knee to run the clock out, he still gets that – angry and just screams at the referee because Saban doesn't understand the rules apparently. So
but I think there's also a level of expectation that we're going to do things the right way and on Saban's part, I think. And the smallest details have to be done right if you're going to win at a high level. And so that's one of the reasons that it works with him getting upset, because he sweats the little details and yells at players when they mess him up. I mean, what they should have done was just had the quarterback, you know, keep backing up the field for a few seconds and then kneel down.
But, yeah, just jog down the field.
Yeah, exactly. So, and,
all right. Well, let's look at the game itself, I guess, a little bit. Yeah, I agree that nothing happened that we didn't sort of expect or foresee. There was nothing unpredictable about it. I thought Jonathan Wallace did about as well as could be expected. He had a few really good throws, particularly to Emory Blake, in it.
Sure, and it was his first road start. He was playing at Alabama against an excellent defense. It was well prepared, and Wallace is a decent quarterback. Doesn't have a great arm. He's not super fast. He's an okay runner. He's not a great runner, and he did what he could do. I mean, on third down, the offensive line gave him some pass protection. He made a couple throws. He ran the ball a couple times, and you know, when things were bad and they couldn't get anybody open, but he wasn't going to go in there and tear them up the way Johnny Manziel did to win the game. I thought the Auburn's running game was about like I expected it to be. It wasn't incredibly productive, and that Mason was okay, but not great. And McCaleb didn't get a whole lot done against the faster defenses like Alabama's. He's not going to be incredibly productive.
Right. But Trey did get 1,000 yards for the season.
He did. I'm shocked that he got there because he was so underused. I just feel like, you know, he could have had 1,500 yards easy.
Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah.
And didn't get it done. And so the idea that he got 1,000 yards and it's a big deal, I mean, to me, that's frustrating. I mean, okay, against LSU, 9 carries. Mm-hmm. Against Arkansas, 6 carries in a close game that we lost. Carries. That's the one that just kills you.
Yeah.
Against Mississippi State, 8 carries.
Yeah, I honestly, I think he got 1,000 yards on like 80 carries for the season. What was his average, you know? I mean, it had to be huge.
It was like 5.5. But I mean, he had 170 carries, but, you know, the games where he had the most carries –
mm-hmm.
You know, Louisiana Monroe and New Mexico State.
Right. Yep. Well, you know, my observation when he got the 1,000 yards, I said, congratulations to Trey Mason for reaching 1,000 yards despite the tough Alabama defense and despite Scott Loeffler.
That's the truth. It's so true. And it's so frustrating to see a couple times we actually had him and the fullback in the same game, and then there were plays where the fullback ran one way and Mason ran the other way.
Yeah,
and I was like, "What are we doing
there? Was that by design, or was that?"
I don't know. I don't know. There's no telling. The defense yesterday was so bad. The Auburn defense. The tackling was as bad. The tackling in 2012 is the worst I've ever seen it at Auburn.
Yeah,
we've had some players who weren't very highly recruited athletes who are walk-ons. But guys who played hard and knew how to tackle and, you know, could go out there and be competitive against SEC defenses. And we had a bunch of guys yesterday who got run over, got pushed around, there's a running joke that we'd be the best two-hand touch team in the country because we're great at getting our hands on people, tackling people is something else.
Well, there was the one moment in the second half where three of our players converged on an Alabama guy, and our guys all ended up on the turf, and he just kept them going. So
that was ridiculous.
That summarized the whole season really to me in that one moment.
It did.
Yeah.
And Yeah, though, and then in the second half, when things got really out of hand, we started playing more younger players, and of course, we put Chris Frost in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a great game, caused a fumble, had three tackles, had a tackle for a loss, and but of course, we, you know, he doesn't know the defense, or whatever, so we couldn't play him against other teams. That just boggles my mind. We played Jonathan Evans instead at outside linebacker, who got completely run over by T.J. Yeldon twice. Once he got carried into the end zone by him. Mm. So, I don't know.
Yeah, that was the one player I was really hoping would not have a big game. And I don't think he had a huge game, did he? I mean, Lacy seemed to be.
No.
At least when I was seeing the stats, Lacy was having a better game than Yeldon was. But
he did, yeah. Lacy had a much better game, but he did plenty of damage against us. It was all painful.
You pointed something out to me about Emery Blake. Do you remember what you
– Sure.
Yeah.
Well, I think Emery Blake has finished in the top five for Auburn receiver in terms of career catches and yards and everything else. I think he's finished in the top five in multiple categories. The only other person who's up there is Carson Bailey, where Blake is the only other one besides Bailey who's in the top five in receptions, yards, and touchdowns. And you think, like, you know, that included this year and last year, where our passing offense was terrible. He easily could have been the number one receiver all time at Auburn if we'd had a quarterback the last 2 years.
Well, exactly, because Carson Bailey had a senior, Pat Nix, who was pretty darn good throwing it around as a senior.
Sure.
And then he had Damian Craig, and then, well, 98, I guess, wasn't great. He had that sort of Mexican fiesta of quarterbacks, but before Leard emerged finally. But yeah, but the thing that's surprising to me is that Bailey and Blake would be that high, considering that both of them had at least one season where they almost did nothing.
Well, I think it just shows that there are not a lot of receivers who come to Auburn and play at a high level for 4 years with good quarterback play. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah, Darvin Adams didn't really get going until 2009. He had, 2 years?
That's right, and left early.
And Zachary. But I think back to, I mean, that, you know, that's up there with the Lawyer Tillmans and the, you know, Damian Craig had a number of good receivers during his time.
Tyrone Goodson.
Yeah, and then there was the four big ones we had during the early Tuberville era, you know, the 2002 to 2005 crowd. They were really good.
They were excellent.
Mm-hmm. So it's quite a compliment to Emery Blake, I think, for sure. Anything else about the actual game? I mean, it just
the one area where you think Auburn at least be competitive is special teams, and we weren't.
Oh, the punting was terrible.
Punting was the worst it's been in years. And then the kick returns weren't any good. So that was an area that was very disappointing. I mean, you think at least in that area we'd maybe at least get a draw out of Alabama, but even in that area, we couldn't outperform.
You know, yeah, if you're going to swap places with Vanderbilt, you've got to have good punting. And all season we have had good punting, at least. He's got lots of practice. You know, that's what I always used to say about Vanderbilt, was Vanderbilt always had the all-SEC punter because he got lots of game practice, you know. But, I mean, Clark's been great all year, but he had a terrible game. So I don't know what was going on. It was just one of those days, you know. I mean – I don't know how anybody could have expected anything different, honestly. So,
nope.
Well, I have a few odd facts about the Alabama-Auburn game and series. Let's see. Let me run through a few. Let's see. Get this. This is a bizarre one. These are in no particular order. Auburn, I dug all this out myself. I didn't see it anywhere. I just sat down and dug around in the statistics for about an hour, which was not very pleasant. And this is just weird. Auburn has not kicked a field goal against Alabama since what year?
Well, let's see. Not the last 2 years. in 2009, did we kick one?
Nope.
We certainly, in 2008, we got destroyed. So 2007?
The last time we kicked a field goal against Alabama was the first quarter of 2007. That is 23 straight quarters of Iron Bowl without a field goal by Auburn. Now, we've attempted, I think, two since then, but we haven't made one since since 345 minutes of football ago. Now, you know, we have scored some touchdowns, and that's not to say I don't mean that to be a total criticism, because yeah, touchdowns are better than field goals, but it's just really odd in a game that is usually kind of close, where every point counts, you know, and coaches are going to take every opportunity to get points, that we haven't kicked a field goal against them and only tried twice in 23 quarters. That I just thought that was really bizarre.
It is weird. And in an era where we've had good kickers.
Yeah, exactly. In the game yesterday, Alabama had 7 touchdowns. Auburn had 7 first downs. So that was pretty brutal.
Ouch.
Let's see. In terms of points, yeah, in the 20 quarters of Iron Bowl football since Tommy Tuberville's famous streak ended, right, at the end of 07, mm-hmm. in the 20 quarters since 2007, Alabama leads Auburn 180-63. And in the last 12 quarters of Iron Bowl football, Alabama won every quarter but the famous second half in 2010. So minus the second half of 2010, the cumulative score is Alabama 118, Auburn 21.
Oh, there you go, right there.
And if you add those two back in, because, you know, I have a thing about, well, if you take away this, well, if you take away that, we'll take away the whole thing, you know. But if you do give back the second half again in 2010, the score is a much more respectable 118-42. So, yeah. That's the Alabama game statistics. I had a couple of other statistics about the season. We're about to I'll just hold off that off until we get to the season. So we wanted to talk about the other bit of news that broke this week. We're breaking a lot of news. There's been some talk about an NCAA investigation. What is your read on all that? Is that anything really new, or what's going on with that?
I don't think there was anything new in that at all. Pat Forty of Yahoo reported it. There's nothing in there that we hadn't heard before. Talked about the Javon Robinson and Memphis stuff with the transcript and allegations that the NCAA has talked about to those people. That wasn't news to me. And the second part was about the two Auburn assistant coaches, Looper and Trooper Taylor, being pulled off the road and recruiting. And that wasn't news. That wasn't news to me either.
That's not a problem now, is it?
No. And, you know, the rumor at the time was that they talked to the Carver quarterback when they weren't allowed to be talking to him, like during the game or after the game or something, right. When college coaches were not allowed to be visiting with recruits, and that it was reported they were pulled off the road. So that wasn't a big shock either. But at the same time, it's not you know, impermissible contact is a minor issue with the NCAA, and it's not going to result in serious sanctions against Auburn or anything. I'm not particularly worried about these two things. And it's stupid. I feel a little bit like when the news came out, I really was like, really again? Mm-hmm. And I feel a little bit like the guy in that Neo in the Matrix movie when they start shooting bullets at him and he starts dodging them, because I'm like, oh, yeah, fine. Another article about an NCAA investigation in Auburn. I'm so worried.
And we just bend backwards and it flies over our head, we hope.
That's right.
Yeah, the Javon Robinson thing. I mean, there hasn't been a smidgen of anything connecting that to Auburn other than that's where he was planning on going, right? There hasn't been any talk that Trooper Taylor had a flashlight and a lockpick and was breaking into their transcript vault, you know?
The other part is that one of the people involved, the counselor or whoever who was fired – was an Auburn fan, supposedly, but there's not any involvement by coaches or anybody officially from Auburn. So it could have been something where this person was acting alone because they wanted, you know, Robinson wanted to go to Auburn. They wanted Robinson to go to Auburn, so they were trying to help him out.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, yeah, I guess the other reason that it caused at least any nervousness on my part is the idea that after we kind of were perceived by some, this, you know, I, Now, you and I and everybody in the Auburn family pretty much knows that there was no wrongdoing with Cam on Auburn's part and really on Cam's part, and it's all good. But there's a general perception that the NCAA got one put over on them by Auburn, and so they are just perpetually running the white glove along our surface top. You know, so,
sure.
So anything that, you know, if somebody's illegally parked in front of the athletic department, I'm nervous that here comes the NCAA.
So. Well, I'm not real worried about that. I think recruiting is very competitive, and I think this staff pushed the envelope a lot with stuff they did, and that drew the attention of other people. And,
yeah.
You know, I think that was part of it.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess we can conclude that it's not going to affect the coaching search and who might be willing to come. I mean, it's not like somebody's going to go, oh, I'm not going to Auburn because they're about to have the hammer drop on them.
No, I don't think that's the issue at all. I don't think – I would be very, very, very surprised if it impacts a potential coach's decision to come to Auburn.
Right. Okay. Okay. I added an extra point since we discussed our show, shocking season numbers. I threw out a few statistics to you a minute ago of some of the weird Iron Bowl-related numbers from the last few years. But, you know, here's just a couple of what I thought was some interesting stuff about – this season for Auburn in general. This was the worst season in modern Auburn history by far. Well, no, not necessarily by far. We had a 3-8 year, but even then we seemed competitive, never really gave up. But yet we only lost 4 games more than last year, and we only lost 4 more than 2009. I mean, if you think about it, you think, wow, this year was just horrible. This year must have just been infinitely worse than anything in the last few years. No, actually, we only lost 4 more games than 2 of the last 3 years. And when you think about this, we were one play away from beating Clemson, a field goal away from beating LSU, and one play away from beating Vanderbilt. And see, those are the kinds of breaks that we routinely got in 2009 and in 2011. Am I right? We would get the little, you know, think about like the end of the Utah State game, right?
Sure.
I mean, when breaks like Utah State, if they had happened this year, we would be at worst 6-6 right now. You know, one break in each of those games and we would be 6-6, probably in some little bowl game. And I don't know if Chizik would be fired if we were 6-6 and going to a bowl game.
Probably not.
Yeah. So, you know, I think we had what I call sort of lucky moments in those 2 years. And it feels like luck left town. And I wonder if luck was another name for Gus.
I believe that.
Yeah.
And not that he is lucky, but that he made a difference.
Right.
In preparation and game planning and managing the game, making plays during the game that helped us win a lot of those close games.
Well, yeah, you know, it's like the Arnold Palmer quote, golf is a game of luck. The more I practice, the luckier I get, right? Well, the more we had Gus to lean on, the luckier we got. And without him, we weren't in position to have fortunate things happen to us. That's kind of how I see it, you know. You have to put yourself in the position for something fortunate to happen. If you don't put yourself in that position, then it's not going to happen regardless.
That's right. That reminds me of the stat that we talked about this week where in conference games at Iowa State and Auburn where he did not have Gus Malzahn on as his coordinator, Chizik was 2-22.
Yeah, that really is an amazing number right there. 2-22, yeah. Now, somebody else point out, well, you could – you know, without Ted Roof, he was bad this year, too. But, I mean, if you really look at what made the difference, I don't think anybody's going to say, oh, if only we had Ted Roof, you know. That would have just made a difference.
No, but clearly the hurry-up offense, slowing the offense down this year, didn't help the defense. And we were better off with Malzahn.
Yeah. Yeah, the whole argument that the hurry-up offense hurt the defense, well – I can't imagine the defense having been any worse than it was this year. And wouldn't it have been interesting if Gus had stayed for another year and our defense had played exactly the same as it did this year? People would be saying, see, that's what happens when you run the hurry-up offense. But we know now that the defensive play was not an artifact or a consequence of the hurry-up offense. It was just awful.
Just bad defense.
Yeah, it didn't need an excuse. It just was bad.
The tempo of the offense has nothing to do with bad tackling and guys not knowing who they're covering.
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you what, don't you think Gus is happy he left when he did?
Sure.
He wouldn't be getting any head coaching jobs this year. I mean, I think, again, I think we might have been 6-6, but even still, you know, so, man. Let's see. Against our two biggest rivals this year, Georgia and Alabama, we were outscored 87-0. If you throw in Arkansas, we were outscored 111-7. If you include Texas A&M, we were outscored 150-21. And against, let me see, yeah, if you add in Mississippi State, okay, so if you go all the way down and include all those teams, you know, the Arkansas, Texas A&M, Ole Miss, Mississippi State, plus Alabama, Georgia, and all that, 243-58. 243-58. I mean, so while the season was really bad in the abstract, I think there's a lot of horror and disgustingness to be found when you really get specific about it, too.
Well, I mean, in conference games, in only SEC games, the average score was the opponent 34, Auburn 10.
Wow.
We averaged 10 points a game in conference play.
Yeah.
You're not going to beat anybody doing that.
No, not unless you're Pat Dye and it's 1982 or something.
And yeah, 88, that would have been okay. But
yeah.
I got a good number for you.
Sure.
At one point, we talked about whether this would end up being the worst defense ever at Auburn.
Mm-hmm.
And mainly because of the Alabama A&M game, we did not surpass last year's total yardage number, which was 5,304.
Wow.
That was how many yards we gave up last year.
So we made improvement, you're saying?
Well, only because opponents ran fewer plays against us this year. We actually gave up more on a per-play basis. This year, Auburn gave up 5.99 yards per play. So basically 6 yards every time the other team snapped the ball. Last year was at 5.7. And if you go back, let's say 2007, it was 4.5. Mm-hmm. So we're giving up a yard and a half more every time the other team snaps the ball in about the same number of plays as we did 5 years ago.
I just can't imagine that they ran, even with the hurry up last year, we didn't really hurry up that much. It's hard for me. I mean, because we had so many three and outs this year. It's hard for me to imagine that the opponent ran fewer plays against us this year than they did last year.
It is hard to believe, but we were in a couple of games last year where it was a lot of, you know, up and down the field a little bit, Utah State, Clemson, those kind of games. So, yeah. Where opponents ran like 100 plays against us. So.
Okay. Well, here's a really strange statistic. We were talking about kicking a minute ago. In the last 5 games, okay, since Vanderbilt, how many field goals have Auburn kicked?
Wow. Well, none against Auburn, and it's Alabama and Georgia.
Yep.
None. Wow.
Have we ever gone the last 5 games of the season without kicking a single field goal? I mean, and having a kicker like Parkey that's so good. I mean, that's just, again, and I don't mean to sound like, well, gosh, I wish we were kicking more field goals. But if the alternative is zero, yeah, I wish we were kicking more field goals. I wish we kicked a field goal against Alabama so they wouldn't have a big zero on us again.
You know, this was the first time we've been shut out against Alabama and Georgia since 1906.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Well, yeah, Parkey kicked a field goal in the fourth quarter at Vanderbilt. Up through that point, he had made 10 field goals on the year. And since then, he has not made a single field goal. So he ends the season with 10 field goals. 10. I think we kicked 10 in one game with Gus as our offensive coordinator. On top of like 7 touchdowns in some games.
That's terrible.
Yeah. He didn't attempt one in the last 3 games. He missed one against A&M, missed one against New Mexico State. I just can't remember a time when Auburn went 5 straight games at all, not to mention the last 5, without making a kick. I mean, and it just shows you how things really fell off the map after that Vanderbilt loss, because up until the Vanderbilt game, we were scoring a few touchdowns, kicking a few field goals, kind of hanging in there a little bit. And after that game is when they just seemed like they folded it up. They said, well, you know, crap, if we can't even beat Vanderbilt, you know, why are we even bothering to put the uniform on? So
that was really a turning point in the season, because we had played LSU tough. That was really the turning, you know, game where everybody thought, oh, we're turning it around maybe. And then we came out 2 weeks later and played terrible against Arkansas at home. And then we went on the road against Ole Miss and Vanderbilt, played poorly in both those games. So was really when it was like, oh, well, there's not going to be a turnaround. It's over.
Right. It's turning worse. It actually took a turn for the worse. Yeah, because we played Clemson pretty darn tough. We let them late. Mm-hmm. And the Mississippi State game was like 28-10, but that's not a blowout. At the time, it seemed like a blowout.
Well, and after the kick return, we were actually winning in the second half of that game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. We were, and the LSU game was the one that we had the best chance to win of any all year, which is hard to believe. So it was really after Vanderbilt that we just kind of – it's like if we played Mississippi State over now, I wouldn't even want to think about it.
Yeah, but they kind of are who they are. They're good because we're bad. They're not a great team. So,
I got something to say about them in a little bit, but I'll wait. Let's see. How many touchdowns would you guess our star offensive players scored this season against SEC competition? Let's go this way. We had four offensive players score touchdowns against SEC competition. Four players score a touchdown.
That's so bad.
Trey Mason, how many did he score?
Two.
Four.
Okay.
I think he had two in one game early and then two since then.
Right.
Emery Blake, how many touchdowns?
Two,
yes. Ontario McCaleb, how many touchdowns?
Against SEC teams, one.
One touchdown and one kickoff return. Mm. He had a run somewhere in there. And then C.J. Uzoma had one touchdown catch against the SEC somewhere in there. So 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 touchdowns scored against SEC competition all season.
It's pathetic.
That's unbelievable. And Trey Mason only four. He should have had 24. He should have 14 at least. So, yeah, that was really, really shocking to me. So, all right, well, that was my little excursion into the shocking season numbers. There seems like there's just nowhere to go but up from on both sides of the ball, you know?
There is. I mean, it cannot possibly get worse on either side of the ball than it was this season for Auburn.
I just can't imagine. Okay, well, we had a topic listed here to talk about the Auburn coaching situation, but obviously that is very much in flux as we speak. I will point out a couple of things. We are bidding adieu to our third straight coach to have an undefeated season at Auburn. We are bidding adieu to our third straight coach to have a bust of Bear Bryant sitting on his desk, the Coach of the Year award. That's just strange to me. Terry Bowden, Tommy Tuberville, Gene Chizik all have a little statue of Bear Bryant that they were the Coach of the Year for 1 year. Pat Dye didn't have one, I don't believe. I mean, I guess 1983 would have been the year if he was ever going to get it, he would have gotten it. And I guess probably Snellenberger got it that year, wouldn't you guess?
I'm not sure. Could have been somebody else. But, I mean,
it wasn't Dye, I don't think.
No. Dye could have won it in 88 to Tommy Hodson. But.
Well, I'm sure Lou Holtz won it that year. So.
Very true.
I know. Every time I was seeing the Notre Dame thing yesterday and seeing Lou Holtz in 88, I was just, you know, balling up my fists and wailing at the sky because, I've always argued 88 was the year we had the best chance. We should have been awarded the national championship in 83. I mean, that should have just – we did everything we really needed to do. 83, we should have been national champions. And New York Times said we were. I agree with them. 88, though – if not for that one play that caused the earthquake in Louisiana, we would have been playing Notre Dame in the Sugar Bowl, and we would have had the home field advantage. We'd have been in blue, and we would have been playing Notre Dame and Lou Holtz for that. And I think we could have taken that Notre Dame team. So
we could have beat them. That defense we had in '88, sure.
Yeah. So I just looking at Notre Dame saying, "Oh, first time since 1988," and I'm like, "And you shouldn't have had it in '88." But anyway. One thing that we do know about the coaching situation is that Jay Jacobs will be on the search committee. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, a lot of people feel like he should have been fired as part of this process, that he's part of the problem and not part of the solution. He's you know, hired Chizik. He gave Chizik the contract extension. He's had problems with other coaches at Auburn. We talked about David Marsh, the swimming coach. He supposedly had a lot of problems with Muschamp, and Muschamp really loves Auburn, but he wasn't going to come back here while Jacobs was here. But, you know, the other side is it's difficult to do a search for an athletic director and a coach at the same time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was one of those things where if we were going to fire Jacobs, we should have fired him and gone and hired an AD and thrown him right into the football coaching search. It's, you can't – you have to have an athletic director to run the athletic department and deal with this kind of situation where you don't have a football coach and you don't have a football staff. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was a lot of it. I think just Jacobs deserved to be fired, probably, but – he's going to get – I mean, the decision's been made, at least for the short term. He's going to get another shot. And I think a lot of it is going to come down to, you know, who does he hire as a coach? Is it a good coach? How does that coach do? But also, does that coach tell Jacobs, you know, you run the athletic department, I run the football program, you stay out of my business?
And that, yes, I mean – it just seems odd that he gets to have a big voice in choosing the next coach based on how the things you mentioned and then the last one has gone. I mean, I guess he can point to saying, I hired a national championship coach. Well, yeah, you did, but you also hired a coach that gave the worst performance in at least modern Auburn football history in the last 50 or 60 years. So, I understand there's constraints, but it still just seems odd to have him turn around and hire the next guy. I do have to admit, I am a slightly bit more comfortable with somebody who has experience with Auburn being on there as opposed to bringing in somebody totally new. Like if we hired, let's just say we hired an assistant AD from like LSU or Washington or North Dakota, right? They would come in and they might not, and I don't want to take this too far because if I say they wouldn't hire a guy that could be an Auburn man, because now you start saying, well, that's how we got Chizik, is because Jacobs felt like Chizik could be an Auburn man as opposed to, you know, who could be the best coach. I don't know. But I just don't know. I guess I'm trying to rationalize why it's not a complete disaster to have Jacobs on that process. Now, who else would be there? It'll be Pat Sullivan. Did we already mention Pat Sullivan and Bo Jackson plus that? You mentioned it. The other gentleman who I don't know who he is.
Matt Crawford.
I don't know who that is. I hope he's like the greatest football coaching talent evaluator ever.
Well, you touched on something that's important in this. Neither you nor I thinks the new head coach needs to have any past connection to Auburn at all. That is not important in any way. They need to be an excellent head coach, and they need to be a good person, and they need to want the job. I mean, that's the criteria. So,
well, I think there's a difference between being an Auburn person versus just being a good fit for Auburn. Tommy Tuberville was not an Auburn person, but he was a good fit.
Sure.
Pat Dye was not an Auburn person at all. He was an Alabama, Georgia person, but he was a perfect fit. Terry Bowden was not, you know, for all that he accomplished, and he accomplished a good bit for us there at the beginning at least, he was never a good fit. Chizik at least had his moments where he seemed like a good fit. So I don't mean to make the bar even harder by saying hire the best coach available. Oh, and there are these other criteria that you also have to meet culturally or socially or personality or appearance or whatever. I don't even know what those would be. I have no idea what those would be. But I would hope that, you know, like, you know, I look around the area and the guy at Baylor, I mean, he looks to me like he stepped out of Smokey and the Bandit. He looks like a NASCAR racer from 1972.
Art Briles.
Yeah, I just don't see him as a fit. Whereas, you know, I look around, I look at Jimbo Fisher, yeah, I could see him at Auburn. I look at Kevin Sumlin, yeah, I could see him at Auburn. So there's coaches that seem, you know, and again, I don't want to put too much weight on that because I could be completely wrong. Who knows? But you just get a sense of who gives you confidence and who seems like they belong there versus who seems like a square peg in a round hole kind of a thing.
Sure. So. Not Lane Kiffin. How about that?
Yeah, exactly. Lane Kiffin have no business at Auburn. Absolutely right. And there's no chance. Well, now tell me this. If Jay Jacobs is on this four-man committee, what percentage likelihood do you see Bobby Petrino playing now?
I don't know. I mean, you and I have talked about this. I don't think we're going to offer Petrino the job. As much as people think he's the slam dunk candidate and that's who people want to hire, I don't think that he's going to be the person that they recommend that we hire. And I don't think he's going to be the next Auburn coach. So,
well, I think that there was a better likelihood of Petrino without Jay Jacobs. With Jay Jacobs on the search committee, I cannot see him ever saying, yeah, let's hire Bobby Petrino. I just don't see them, because with Jacobs, I think a lot of his choice of Chizik was that they saw eye to eye on a lot of things. They had similar personalities, I think. They meshed really well. And I just can't see the abrasive, potty-mouthed, you know, Bobby Petrino meshing with Jay Jacobs. I just can't see that. I mean, I couldn't care less how he talks, but I mean, that's, you know, I can remember seeing him on the sideline next to Tuberville just cussing a blue streak and Tuberville kind of looking at him with one eyebrow raised like, good gosh, you know? So I don't know. But if we had a completely different search committee, I can't even imagine Bo saying, yeah, we need Bobby Petrino. Or Pat Sullivan.
That'd be interesting. You know what I learned today when I was researching? I was doing a little bit of research before we started about the members of our search committee. Hmm. Did you know that Pat Sullivan was offered the LSU job at one point?
You know, I remember him being in the running for it. I don't know that I knew he was offered it.
Supposedly, when he was the head coach at TCU in the early 90s, LSU fired their old coach, and Pat Sullivan was the number one choice. And they interviewed him. They'd agreed to hire him. They could not work out the deals of buyout with TCU, so he couldn't leave. Huh. So he stayed at TCU, and LSU hired your favorite, Jerry DiNardo.
Yeah, I'd like to think that Pat could get hired over Jerry DiNardo. But that would be after Mike Archer left, right, I guess. Or was there another one in between Archer and DiNardo? Oh, Curly Hallman.
Yeah, Curly, I was the guy who kept throwing the ball against Auburn.
That's kind of funny that we would be responsible not only for Curly Hallman getting fired, but then also for them having an Auburn guy as their next coach. Because it was absolutely that Auburn game. We got Curly Hallman fired, and then we turned around and got DiNardo fired in 99.
That's right.
It was the Auburn game both seasons that I think LSU just kind of said, all right, that's enough of this guy. So, but you know, in the bigger picture, I really just feel like there's a lot of people out there still that when we look to hire, then they look to hire a new football coach. They look for that guy that can be like the Bear Bryant, the Shug Jordan, the Dooley, and be a 25-year coach. And honestly, with a few exceptions, I just don't think that there are 25-year coaches out there anymore. I think that era is gone, because if you are unsuccessful, you're not going to make it five, right? Much less 25. And if you are That's successful, right. You're going to go off to the NFL or go to some other job. And so the days of a coach just kind of moving into the community and being there forever are, for the most, then there's a few exceptions here and there, but for, like, you know, the Joe Paterno, but he's kind of gone now. And Bobby Bowden, but he's gone. So we really are coming to the day and age now when there's hardly any of those old coaches that are just institutions at a school that are left. And because of that fact, I really feel like we have to quit trying to hire those kind of coaches. I think there's something to be said for figuring you're going to get between 5 and 8 years out of a coach, and they're going to be gone one way or the other at the end of that period. And I mean, you know, I've said this before. I'm not sure if it was here or in a column or what, but I just feel strongly. I mean, if you look at international soccer, and I'm sorry, football fans, to bring this up, but it's an interesting cross sport parallel of how coaching searches and coaching tenures work. When you look at Brazil, Brazil doesn't go two World Cups in a row, and they're 4 years apart. For those that don't care about soccer, Brazil never goes two World Cups in a row with the same coach. They bring a coach in and a new staff, and they coach for 4 years, and either they win the World Cup or they don't, and more often than not, they do. And then they fire him. And the coach knew that coming in. The fans knew that. Everybody knows it. And they justify it by saying, if you give him more than 4 years, everybody else is going to figure out what he does, and you're not going to win. So there is something to be said for bringing a coach in for 3, 4, 5 years, winning a national championship like Chizik, and then showing him the door and finding something new. it seems kind of mercenary and cutthroat, but honestly, I think that's the way this business, that's a business now, is really kind of going.
Well, and also, I think a lot of what you said works in college football and the NFL, where it seems that after about 10 years, the kind of fatigue sets in.
Yeah.
Everybody's kind of heard all the speeches. Everybody's seen what you can do. And unless you really shake things up, 10 years is about as long as a head coach needs to be in one place at this point.
Yeah. When Tuberville left, I mean, I know that 08 kind of hustled him out the door, but I didn't really cry. I mean, I felt like, you know, you gave us 10 years. 10 years is about all that you can really, you know, realistically expect from any coach these days. And he was frankly fortunate after 2003, the way it played out, to get five more.
That's right.
So, yeah, I think you're right. 10 is about the maximum now, and we just shouldn't be surprised if the tenures don't last very long. I'm surprised Oklahoma's kept Stoops this long, to be honest.
But so the lesson from that is, don't hire a coach that you think is becoming a great coach, is right, going to be a great coach in 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, get somebody who's good now.
Yeah, yeah. And get everything you can out of them before they crumble or they climb out the attic to the next thing.
That's right.
So, yeah. And you don't try to lock them in with these $7 million buyouts, because you're probably going to want to fire them anyway. And if you don't, you know, they may be wanting to leave. And
well, I mean, who was the last SEC coach to leave an SEC head coaching job for another college job?
Man.
For another non-SEC
job. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, Spurrier and Saban both went to the NFL and then came back.
You had guys like
Perkins. No, he went to the NFL.
Went to Tampa.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it doesn't happen.
No.
So, you know, you're not worried about somebody coming in and hiring the guy away.
Urban Meyer kind of did, but he had like an excuse basically.
I mean, he retired and came back. I mean,
yeah.
Florida would have kept him if he wanted to stay there.
So. Yeah. If things hadn't been kind of getting very weird, you know, I think so. Well, you want to move to the other games around the country and around the SEC?
Sure.
By the way, I wanted to mention this before we do. I had forgotten. I hated seeing the obligatory news postings and tweets saying that the Auburn players were all wanting Chizik to come back, and they were all like, sure, he was the guy to fix it and everything. Because, you know, what's news is when players say, oh, you got to get our coach out of here. We got to get rid of this guy. That's news. I can't think of a time there's ever been a coach, no matter how bad the season was, that the players didn't say, oh, we need to have him back. It'll be better, you know. They always say that. So that to me was not and should not have ever been a factor, because players always do that. And that's good. I mean, they're loyal. I appreciate that. But it shouldn't have, and it didn't apparently make any difference. So, you know, I said even after 1980, I'm sure all the Auburn players are saying, let's just keep Doug Barfield. I know he's going to turn this thing around next year. And then after the spring practice of 81 with Pat Dye, I'm sure they really wanted Barfield back. They're dying, right? You know that.
No, but it's also, I mean, they came to Auburn because they have a connection with him and the staff, and so it's, nobody likes change.
Yeah.
Change is hard. It's hardest on the players, but it's hard on all of us, and it's gonna be a long couple weeks while we deal with the rumors and the, you know, tracking the airplanes and all that stuff. So.
Great. What kind of a timetable do you see coming out of this? Do you have any sense of it?
No, I mean, I think you have to be aggressive because you're competing with the other SEC schools for the good candidates. So, you know, Arkansas and Tennessee and these other people are out there calling head coaching candidates already. So it's good that we did this. And there's some discussion of, we'll wait till December 1st because the buyout will go down. No, do not sweat that money a bit.
Yeah.
Because if there's only one good coaching candidate there, you wait, and Arkansas or Tennessee gets him and we don't, then that was a mistake.
Yeah.
So go ahead and eat that money. It's much more important to get the right person, and if you have to move quickly to do it, that's what you have to do, and I'm glad Auburn did it in this case.
You know, it's kind of unfortunate in a way. I mean, when we compete with Florida or Alabama or LSU even for a coach, I always feel like, well, we're not going to be competing head-to-head for the same guy with them. They just, for whatever reason, we don't tend to go in the same direction. And I think that they probably would have more money maybe to offer, or slightly, I don't know, not much. But see, Tennessee and Arkansas, with no offense to either one of them, I would put Arkansas slightly below us in terms of, you know, prestige or who we should be able to hire. And Tennessee's always been on kind of a par with us, I think, at least in the modern era. I know they had their period where they were better, and we've had some good decades too. But generally speaking, I think that Auburn, Tennessee, kind of on a par. Arkansas, like about a half a step below maybe at this point, because they've had some good years now. And I hate that we're competing for sort of that same level of coach, the same type of coach.
I mean, in some years there's more obvious candidates than others. And
yeah.
It happens when it happens, and you have to hire the best person you can at that time. So,
and there's just not a lot of obvious candidates. I mean, a lot of the ones that are kind of obvious seem to have been being settled into their early years in their new job, in their current job. So
that's right.
It's just going to be very interesting to see what they come up with, because I really have no idea. I mean, other than Gus, Gus is obviously the sort of, I don't want to say he's the safe choice, but you know he's there. You know you can throw money at him. You know he's not at Notre Dame, you know, or Michigan. So it's not like he's going to say, oh, I would never leave here to go to Auburn. He's at a school, Arkansas State, that he could, you know. Now, you've made the points in the past that he may not want in the SEC. He may want to be like the Chris Peterson of the Sun Belt, and that may very well be true. But at least he's not at a place where he would laugh if Auburn offered him, right? He'd have to at least think about it for a minute.
Sure. And it may be that he, you know, he left because he saw what the situation was under Chizik at Auburn, and that it was going to be bad, and he didn't think they were ever likely to get back to that level again. And he had to jump on a head coaching job while he could.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe. Let's see. Well, I've actually got more non-SEC points, but I will make one SEC point for sure and then see if you got any. When we watched Florida State yesterday, we watched South Carolina, Clemson, Georgia Tech. I don't think you could make any argument that the SEC was just head and shoulders above the ACC this year. I mean, that was what an embarrassing day for the ACC.
Well, I mean, it's been a bad week for them. They've lost Maryland to the Big Ten, and then turned around and the SEC head to head crushes them.
Yeah,
and several of those games were on the road. I mean, the Florida State game was in Tallahassee.
Yeah.
The South Carolina game was at Clemson.
Yep.
I'm not sure where the Vanderbilt game was. Was it at Wake Forest or was it?
I don't know. I forgot about that one. I know that Georgia Tech was actually in Athens, but
right. So, but at least two of them were on the road, and the SEC teams crushed them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a big step back for the ACC, and it just kind of shows people want to jump on the SEC and say, "Oh, it's not as good. It's not as good," but the top of the SEC is pretty darn good.
I've got to give it up for Hugh Freeze, who sounds like a Batman villain. Prior to this season, I was sure the only thing that he was the answer to was the question, who was the high school coach in that Sandra Bullock movie? But it turns out he was actually the answer to how does Ole Miss get pretty competitive again. I'm really startled at how quickly he's turned Ole Miss's fortunes around. I think he's not coach of the year in the conference, but he's got to be, you know, like a strong second or third in there somewhere.
I think he is coach of the year in the conference. I think he's done an amazing job. I mean, there's two things here. One is he went to Arkansas State, won 10 games there.
Yep.
He was successful. Yep. He was a good head coach at Arkansas State. They were organized. They had a good offense. He brought it to Ole Miss. They had better players. He recruited well, signed some JUCO guys, and you could immediately tell the difference on the field when you watch the team this year versus last year. Ole Miss was much better organized. They had a really good offensive system, and they played hard for him.
Yeah.
And so I think Hugh Freeze deserves a lot of credit for turning that program around. I think he's going to do a good job there. The other side is, if you're Auburn, to me, that same thing can happen here.
Right.
We hire the right person, they can walk in the door, and the turnaround will be just as dramatic, and it'll be even more dramatic because I think we have more talent than Ole Miss does.
Right, exactly, yeah. Well, I mean, Chizik showed that, you know, in 2 years, just, you know, and that's kind of the standard these days. You bring in a good coach, and on the second year or third year, maybe he gets you to the national championship. So I think there's no doubt that Auburn can turn things around very quickly. Now you mentioned that maybe Hugh Freeze is coach of the year. I think his main competition is because you could make an argument right now that the two best teams in the country are Stanford and Texas A&M. I mean, I could see – I feel like Stanford and Texas A&M are playing as good, if not better, than anybody in the country. And before you laugh too much, remember Stanford just beat Oregon. Stanford just beat Oregon, and Texas A&M just beat Alabama.
Well, and Stanford basically beat Notre Dame. I mean, if you go back and watch the end of that game, they were in South Bend, and they kind of got
– yeah,
you know, it was a close game. It went down to the last play of the game, and they had a couple of good dives at the goal line at the end and got stopped. You know, some people feel like they should have been reviewed more one of the plays at the goal line. But, I mean, they clearly – Stanford is as good as anybody in the country. And Texas A&M went and beat Alabama. So I'm not going to argue with you that if we had like a 16-team tournament today, an 8-team tournament, and those two teams were in there, then they would certainly be dangerous.
Yeah, they look like the kind of basketball team that kind of suddenly takes a number three or four seed and goes all the way to the Final Four.
Sure. You don't want to play them in a bowl game.
No. And I tell you, Texas A&M looks like the new Oregon to me.
Oh, yeah.
All they got to do is just make some kind of a deal to get every kind of strange uniform from whoever their supplier is, and they can be the Oregon of the SEC. See, I thought that's who we were going to be 2 years ago. I thought, oh, we're the Oregon of the SEC now. Here we go. And, well, no, we're the Washington State of the SEC right now. But, another SEC point. Jadeveon Clowney yesterday looked like Lawrence Taylor against Clemson.
Well, I mean, he looks like that a lot.
Yeah. You know, he's the,
in terms of individual players in the SEC who are great on defense, the two that have really leapt out to me this year watching other teams are Clowney and then that safety for Florida.
Yeah.
Elam, he just crushes people. But, I mean, Clowney is the best defensive lineman in the SEC. And whenever he comes out, he's going to be the first or second player picked in the draft.
Mm-hmm.
He just can take over games. I mean, you saw him do it the other games Florida played this year when they played Georgia. Even when they're at LSU, he had a good game there. So he's a dominating player.
Well, we knew he would be when he came out of high school. And you remember his two choices were South Carolina and
us.
Alabama.
Alabama, that's right.
Yeah, you think about Lattimore. Lattimore was South Carolina and us, but Clowney was Alabama and South Carolina. And when South Carolina got him, I was so happy because I did not want that guy in an Alabama uniform for 3 or 4 years on the opposite side of the field. There was just no way. Now, we did handle him last year. You know, we actually beat South Carolina last year. People
sure
forget that. But, I mean, he's just this year he just seems to be playing even better, and I just thought I would mention that. Any other SEC teams? I got a few thoughts about the Notre Dame, USC, and UCLA, but
I guess the amazing thing to me is that, you know, Florida is 11-1. They're in the computer rankings, they're number one, not Alabama or Notre Dame. Florida's number one. Although I read this morning, Notre Dame has beaten 9 bowl eligible teams, Alabama has beaten 5, and Florida has beaten 4.
Wow. Now, see, I would have never guessed that Notre Dame had beaten that many good teams. You just, you know, the as they say, the media bias is so, I mean, because, well, now, see, people will say, oh, the media is biased pro-Notre Dame, and I get that, but there's so much anti-Notre Dame backlash in the secondary media that I just have been assuming they've been playing high school teams.
Oh. No, I mean, you know, Southern Cal didn't have a quarterback last night, but that's, you know, going there and beating them is a legitimate win.
Yeah.
They beat Stanford. They beat Michigan. They beat Michigan State. They beat Miami. They beat Oklahoma in Oklahoma. That was a huge game.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I mean, Purdue, BYU, those, I mean, Navy, Wake Forest. So
they beat some pretty good and pretty decent teams in there.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, to me, you know, Oklahoma and Stanford are legitimate, you know, top 10 kind of teams.
Absolutely.
They beat both of those, so.
Absolutely. One other SEC thing. I want to know what you think about Arkansas right now because, you know, the storyline kind of in the beginning of the season was, well, they didn't have Petrino, and so they kind of stumbled coming out of the gate. But honestly, if you looked at that team over the course of the year, was it really the absence of Petrino? I mean, how good could they have been if he had been with them?
And would they really have been a national championship contender with this team with one extra coach? I mean, I honestly suspect that they might have been about an 8-4 team with him coaching. What do you think?
I think that's probably fair. I think, you know, they clearly would have been better on offense. I think people underestimate how good those receivers were they had last year, how much losing them hurt.
Yeah.
But I think they did get a little bit better over the course of the season, where they were, you know, terrible at the start of the year, but they kind of turned it around and got it going. And you got to think, if Petrino was there, they wouldn't have lost to Louisiana Monroe. They wouldn't have lost to Rutgers. They lost to Ole Miss by 3 points, you know, at home. Those kind of things, mm-hmm. you know, they just scored more points in those games. So, you know, I don't think they would be a national title contender, but they'd be, you know, a legitimate 8-9-10-1 kind of team.
I wonder what it would have done to Petrino's stock if all this hadn't happened and he'd come in with all this hype this year and coach this team to 8-4, 9-3. I mean, I think that would have been a blow. See, it's almost like, you know, this is like one of those when the celebrity dies young and we remember him pretty.
Sure.
Petrino looks a lot more attractive right now because he died young, so to speak, than if he'd actually lived, in football terms, I mean, to coach a kind of a disappointing season. I just can't imagine that half of the Auburn family would be all hot to hire Petrino right now if he turned in an 8-4 campaign with Tyler Wilson and that whole crowd. And you know, it is pretty closely divided. If you just do a random sampling on Twitter, and I know that's not, you know, a scientific poll by any means, but if you look there, every other tweet about Petrino is never in a million years I hate Petrino, and then we've got to hire him immediately, and then no, I don't want him at all, and then yes, we've got to have him. And people are just like diehard one way or the other.
Here's the other name that's out there you and I haven't talked about at all. I wanted to ask your opinion about.
Okay.
That you keep hearing. Jeff Fisher of the St. Louis Rams.
Well, you wouldn't know. I live right outside St. Louis. You wouldn't know that Fisher was here because you wouldn't know that the Rams were here. There's nobody in this whole area cares about the St. Louis Rams. They're off the radar completely. There's the Cardinals, and that's about it. Maybe the Blues a little bit, the hockey team. But they've had a horrible season this year. They had just started turning it around before he came in, I think. I mean, the vogue thing to do now is to get an NFL coach that can come in and say, yeah, you know, you come play for me at wherever, and I'm an NFL coach. I can coach you how to play in the NFL. But if you're not a great coach, then and he's always struck me as just kind of a very sort of a very vanilla coach. He doesn't have a strong coaching personality or really a strong personality, period. So I guess the only advantage I can see is he's got a lot of coaching experience. His son's on the team, right?
Yes. For whatever that's worth. Yes. He makes $7 million a year and he's not going to get fired.
Right.
So why would he leave that to come to a college job where he would make half that much?
He might get fired next year the way it's going right now.
And I'm one of those people, like a lot of college coaches come back to the NFL and do a pretty poor job. I'm not in a rush to hire an NFL person.
Yeah. I don't see what there is to recommend him other than he lost a Super Bowl one time.
I mean, I think he was a very good coach for years in Tennessee, but that doesn't mean we need to hire him tomorrow. So.
Yeah, and he's never been a college coach as far as I know. So
no.
Does he even know how to recruit? Does he have any connection with the high schools and other players or anything? I mean, you know, that's one thing that worries me about like getting like a Chris Peterson. I know he's a good coach, but he'd really be starting from scratch in terms of recruiting and making relationships and everything. That's one way that I could actually say, yeah, I do understand the logic of like a Jimbo Fisher. Whether he's a great coach or not, at least if he's a pretty good coach and he knows everybody, he's got Damian Craig already on his staff, you know, he can recruit.
He's done a great job recruiting.
Yeah, exactly. That's the one thing about Jimbo that I can see. I could kind of say, yeah, I wouldn't cry if they hired him. I would be very much wait and see. Let's see if he can actually get it done. But yesterday's results don't encourage me a whole lot, to be honest. But they are going to the ACC championship game, which is currently about the same prestige level as playing in the Papa John's Bowl.
Good tickets still available.
Exactly. And that brings me to my other point about championship games. Okay, let me set the stage for you. UCLA got beaten pretty bad by Stanford yesterday. Their reward and Stanford's reward is to play UCLA again on Friday, this Friday, 6 days later, in the Pac-12 championship game, while 11-1 Oregon stays home. When that kind of thing happens with your conference, when you know that year after year, one team in the championship game is probably going to be substandard, right? To me, to have a legitimate conference championship game, your conference needs to be on a sort of a overall level that you're confident that most years, at least one team on each side will be competitive at the highest level. This has happened to the ACC over and over and over, right? And that's happening to the Pac-12. It's kind of happening to the Big Ten because they've got so many issues with Ohio State and Penn State. Yeah, so when you're reaching down to like the third place team, or if the first place team in one division is like 6-6, and this isn't the first time. Didn't this happen with UCLA last year, year before last? Yeah,
it did last year.
You know something is not right somewhere with your whole scheme of things when that's happening.
Well, you shouldn't have games outside of your division the last game of the season to prevent this kind of thing. Because if you have games between like teams in the other division, you're going to end up with the championship game being a rematch of one of those eventually. The one thing the Pac-10 did that I think is really smart is that their championship game is on the team with the best records home field. Because you look at the ACC, they're selling 20,000 tickets a year to this game because fans of the good teams want to wait, go to the bowl game. They don't want to go sit outdoors in Charlotte in December and watch the championship game. So, I think the Pac-10 made a smart decision and said, look, you got the best record. You get the championship game on your home field. Guaranteed sellout. Pac-10, everybody makes money. Fans of that team, you get a reward for having a good year. And I think, we don't need to do that in the SEC because it would be a huge competitive advantage and we're having no problem selling out the game.
Right.
But in other conferences, that's a smart business decision.
Well, there's a couple of things. That's a really good point. There's a couple of things that happened. I mean, the SEC had an existing established sort of it's us against the world already kind of mentality. And so when you create the SEC championship game, that's almost like the Super Bowl. And then the national championship would just be a bonus. And so we think of winning the SEC first generally. And so that championship and the SEC championship game is really seen as like a destination. It's something the players all strive for. They focus on getting there. And I really feel like in like the ACC or whatever, they're like, what? We have to go to Charlotte? We have to play another game against some 6-6 team, really? If your championship game, like I say, is seen by players participating in it as kind of an onerous difficulty, right? A millstone around the neck of getting on to wherever your business was, that's not a good thing. And it's funny because if you remember back in 1991-92, there were a lot of people that said that's how the SEC would look at it. And we haven't. Sure. It's been much more successful than most people thought, I believe.
Well, it's just because it's a championship game is more SEC football, and that's not a bad thing. So.
Right. Right, and a lot of the years it's not a rematch, which has been now some years it has. It's probably about half and half, I would guess, but So,
do we want to talk about that game for a minute?
Yeah,
I think Georgia is going to give Alabama all they want.
Yep,
I think Georgia's defense is good enough to slow down Alabama, to shut down the running game a little bit, and I think Alabama has shown that they don't have a Jadeveon Clowney type in the front seven who can just beat anybody at any time and get pressure on the quarterback. And so I think we've seen when they played really good quarterbacks like, Mettenberger and Johnny Manziel, they had real problems. And I think Aaron Murray has been to this game before. Georgia's not going to be intimidated by being in the Georgia Dome in this environment. And I think Aaron Murray's going to play well against him. And I think Georgia's defense is good enough to keep him in the game.
Yeah, no, I don't feel confident making a prediction, but I do think Georgia, under the right circumstances, if the moon is in the right place in the sky, Mars is in the seventh house and all that, Georgia could win this game. If Texas A&M can beat Alabama, Georgia can beat Alabama.
Sure.
But and I think Georgia will be the home team.
I don't think it matters.
I don't think it matters, but just, you know, for whatever good it does, they'll be out there in that bright red. But, yeah, I feel like it's a possible, doable thing, and it sure would be interesting if that happens. Because I never dreamed Georgia would have a chance of getting the national championship game this year, much less be in the national semifinals, basically.
It is fun that it's basically a semifinal, yeah. You know, 2 years before we have the playoff, but
yeah, and meanwhile, Notre Dame would like to take this opportunity to laugh at everybody who said they should join the Big Ten and play in a conference championship game. Notre Dame's laughing all the way to the bank. You know,
right.
Notre Dame thinks it's hilarious that they have to that somebody's having to play in a championship game in a conference championship.
Unlike every other team, they're not sharing that pot when the check from the BCS comes.
Yep. They just get to finish off against USC and just stroll down to Miami.
That's right.
All right. Well, I think we, again, as in the immortal words of Jim Fife, our time is up. We thank you for yours. John, I guess we'll tune into the SEC championship game next week. And then after that, we'll be back to kind of see what's happened in the world of coaching searches and in the world of postseason play. And, you know, we'll stick around. So, you know, if you folks will hang in there with us, we'll be with you to see the dawning of a new age of Auburn football.
I can't wait to come back on here at some point in the near future and talk about the next Auburn coach.
Fantastic. All right. War Eagle, everybody. War Eagle, John.
War Eagle, man.
See ya.
Bye.